Welcome to another deep dive. Today we're going to tackle a question that I think has fascinated humans since, well, forever. What makes us, Homo sapiens, different? And we've got a mountain of research to help us figure that out. We're talking fossils, genetics, the whole evolution of cultures, and even those things called memes. It's going to be a wild ride.
It is. We're basically diving deep into the science of what makes our species unique. We've got a ton of material to go through, but by the end, you'll have a much better grasp on our origins and really the entire journey that's led us to where we are today as a species.
So if you're ready to unlock some serious knowledge about humanity, you've come to the right place. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's break down what makes us a distinct species in the first place. How do scientists even go about figuring that out?
Well, the most basic definition of a species is that it's a group of organisms that can interbreed and make offspring that can also reproduce, right? You see this all over nature, like with canids, for instance. Wolves, foxes, dogs, they all came from a common ancestor. Same with the Felidae family, all those cool cats. You get so much diversity, but they're still distinct species.
Okay, that makes sense. But how do scientists actually figure out when Homo sapiens split off and became its own thing? Can't be just one fossil that does the trick, right?
You're right. It's way more complicated than that. Genetics is a huge part of the puzzle now. Scientists analyze the DNA from fossils, compare it to what we see in living species, and try to figure out the relationships. The thing is, even within one species or population, there's natural variation in DNA. So drawing those lines, figuring out when one species becomes another, it's really tough. And with these early hominins like Homo erectus, Habilis, Ergaster, Rudolfensis, it gets even more challenging. There's some pretty compelling research that suggests some of these might not be separate species at all. They could just be variations within one lineage, maybe even all part of Homo erectus originating way back in Africa.
So it's less about rigid categories and more about understanding how these different forms fit into the overall evolutionary picture.
Exactly. It's about understanding those connections and how they change over time.
Got it. Now, what about our geographic origins? Out of Africa, that's still the prevailing theory, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the dominant hypothesis for sure. The idea is that a large group of Homo sapiens migrated out of Africa around 60,000 years ago, and most of the global population today descended from them. It's not a slam dunk, though. There are other theories out there proposing multiple smaller migrations, and these might have happened much earlier, like 200,000 or even 300,000 years ago. The research is still ongoing.
It's amazing to think how far we've spread across the globe. Okay, so that's the broad strokes of our origins. Now let's dive into paleoanthropology. What exactly does that field study?
Paleoanthropology is a fascinating blend of paleontology, you know, the study of fossils, and biological anthropology, which is all about the biological and behavioral aspects of humans and those closest to us on the evolutionary tree. So paleoanthropologists, they basically examine the fossil evidence of prehumans and humans to trace our journey through time. It's like detective work on a grand scale.
Fascinating. It's about piecing together the story of not just our physical evolution, but also the development of the human mind, right?
Precisely.
Okay, now I see these terms thrown around a lot. Hominoids, hominids, hominin. Can you clarify those?
Sure. So the broadest term is hominoids. That includes all the apes without tails, you know, gibbons, orangutans, gorillas, chimps, and us. Then within that group are the hominids. And traditionally, that meant the human-like apes. But things get a little messy there because the classifications evolved. Nowadays, you'll often hear the term hominin instead of hominid, and that specifically refers to chimps, humans, and all those extinct pre-human forms more closely related to us than other apes. It's the branch of the family tree we're most interested in for our purposes today.
That's helpful. Now, one of our sources for this deep dive is Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape, and I have to say that book caused quite a stir back in its day. What were its key arguments about human evolution?
Oh yeah, The Naked Ape, that was a real game changer when it came out in 1967. Morris basically argued that to really understand human behavior, we need to view ourselves as a unique type of primate, a hairless primate, in fact, but one still driven by those underlying animal instincts, those primal urges that we've inherited. He really challenged a lot of the social norms at the time.
And that whole hairlessness thing, our source connects that to the endurance running hypothesis, right? What's the logic there?
Right. The endurance running hypothesis basically suggests that our ancestors lost all that thick body hair as an adaptation for long distance running, especially for hunting. Think about it, humans. We're actually remarkably persistent runners. We can outlast a lot of animals over long distances. And losing that fur, combined with sweating, which is a really efficient way to cool down compared to panting, well, that would have given those early hunters a huge advantage as they chased prey across the open savanna.
That's so cool. So basically, our ability to run and sweat those became some of our defining characteristics.
Exactly.
Now, the source also mentions Rumpelpithecus, which was originally thought to be a hominin ancestor, but has now been reclassified. What led to that change?
Yeah, you see, the methods we use to understand evolutionary relationships, they've gotten so much better over the years. When Rumpelpithecus was first discovered, scientists thought it was a human ancestor. But then we started using genetic analysis and comparing skeletons in a much more detailed way, and it became clear that Rumpelpithecus actually belongs on the orangutan branch of the evolutionary tree, not the human one. It's a good example of how science is always refining our understanding of the past as new evidence comes to light.
It's amazing how much we've learned about our family tree. Speaking of which, the source points out that our ancestors were probably mostly right-handed, and they've got evidence from tool use and even damage on animal skulls to back that up. It's pretty different from other apes, right?
Yeah, it is. In most ape species, you don't really see a strong preference for one hand over the other. But with humans, right-handedness is dominant in almost every population around the world. And the evidence for this goes way back. Think about the wear and tear on ancient tools, the marks left on animal bones during hunting, even the way those early cave paintings were made. It all points to a strong right-hand bias. And it's not just about motor skills. This consistent right-handedness across populations tells us something really interesting about the human brain. It suggests a level of specialization, what we call lateralization, where certain brain functions are concentrated in one hemisphere over the other. This could be linked to how we developed language and other complex skills.
So even something as seemingly simple as which hand we prefer could have deep roots in our evolution. Now let's zoom out a bit. What's the overall timeline of primate evolution according to the research we have?
Okay, so primates first appeared over 50 million years ago, and they originated in Africa. That's the general consensus. Now, here's the interesting part. Some of the earliest primate fossils have actually been found in Asia, which suggests that there was a period of diversification in Asia before they made their way back to Africa.
That's really cool. So these early primates are moving around, spreading out.
Yeah.
How did they manage to get to different continents and islands? Our source mentions Darwin's idea of animals hitching rides on natural rafts. Is that something scientists take seriously?
They do. It's not as crazy as it sounds. We call it sea dispersal, and it's when animals or even plants end up on floating debris like vegetation and get carried away by currents. There's a lot of evidence to support this idea. It's probably how a lot of species, including primates, ended up on islands. It's even possible that it played a role in the spread of early Homo sapiens to new areas.
It's mind-boggling to think about these early humans drifting across oceans on rafts.
It is. Imagine what that journey must have been like.
I can't even imagine. Okay, let's get back to our direct lineage. When did the gene mixing between our pre-human ancestors and chimpanzees stop? And what about later interbreeding with other hominin groups?
Well, most of the gene flow between the lines leading to chimps and humans, that likely ended around 5.5 million years ago. But there's a twist. Later on, as our ancestors were evolving and moving around, they interbred with other hominin groups. Neanderthals and Denisovans, they're the big ones everyone's heard of.
Right, and our source has some fascinating specifics about this mixing, right? It wasn't just a little bit of gene swapping.
Absolutely. Take Denisovans, for example. We know from the DNA analysis from Denisova Cave in Siberia that people living in the Pacific Islands today, like Melanesians and Papuans, they've got around 5 to 6% Denisovan DNA. Europeans, on the other hand, they've only got about 0.1%. What's really fascinating is that Denisova Cave has yielded evidence of all three groups, Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, and Denisovans living there at different times. And get this, one of the most amazing discoveries was a bone fragment from an individual who had a Denisovan mother and a Neanderthal father, a first-generation hybrid. So the takeaway here is this. Our lineage isn't some pure straight line. It's a mix. We are a hybrid species with genetic contributions from these other groups, and that's pretty awesome.
A first-generation hybrid. I mean, that just blows my mind. It really makes you question those neat categories we try to put on everything. But what about those more recent hominid discoveries, like Homo luzonensis in the Philippines? What's that all about?
Homo luzonensis, yeah. That was discovered in the Philippines, and the fossils are from about 67,000 years ago. It's another piece of the puzzle that highlights just how diverse these recent human-like forms really were. And Homo luzonensis was significantly smaller than us. Homo sapiens.
It's incredible how many branches there are on our family tree. The Human Genome Project, that was such a huge accomplishment. What were its main goals, and how has it changed our understanding of human evolution?
The Human Genome Project was a massive undertaking. When it launched in 1990, the goal was to map the entire human genome in 15 years, and it was going to cost billions of dollars. The really cool thing is that they ended up finishing the first draft way ahead of schedule, like around the year 2000. And as you can imagine, this really sped up our ability to analyze DNA. What used to take years and cost millions can now be done much quicker and cheaper. So now we've got tons of new projects. Scientists are sequencing thousands of genomes to look at variations, and they're even analyzing DNA from extinct hominins. It's giving us such amazing insights into our relationships with these other human groups.
It's incredible what we can do with genetics now. So specifically, what have we learned about our connection to Neanderthals and other hominins thanks to all these advances?
Well, for starters, we now know that most people of Eurasian descent, they've got about 1 to 4% Neanderthal DNA in them. And these inherited genes, they've actually been linked to various traits. Some of them are pretty surprising. We're talking susceptibility to certain diseases, nicotine addiction, even the structure of our skin cells and our immune responses to some viruses. And it doesn't stop there. There's evidence of interbreeding with other lineages as well. We're finding traces of genetic material from several unidentified hominin groups in the genomes of people worldwide. Current estimates say that up to 8% of the DNA in modern humans could have come from this mixing with Denisovans, Neanderthals, and those smaller hominins from places like Flores, Luzon, and the caves in China.
So we're more of a genetic mosaic than a purebred species. It's fascinating. Now, our source also mentions this really interesting fact. The amount of our DNA that actually codes for human proteins is tiny compared to our microbiome. And even the viral and bacterial genes that have made their way into our DNA. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's really humbling when you think about it. Of all those billions of DNA base pairs, we have like around 3 billion. Only a small fraction actually codes for the proteins that make up our bodies and keep them running. We're talking about maybe 20,000 genes. And this makes up only about 43% of the cells in our bodies. The other 57%, that's our microbiome, the trillions of bacteria living in and on us, each with its own set of genes. And get this, hundreds of the genes in our DNA actually originated from viruses and bacteria that managed to insert their genetic material into ours over millions of years. So when we talk about being human, it's not just about our own genes. We're walking ecosystems with way more non-human genes than the ones that code for our own proteins.
It really changes how you view the whole concept of self. The source then goes on to talk about organisms as being more like ongoing processes rather than fixed objects. And they use the example of metamorphosis, like with butterflies. What's the connection there to understanding Homo sapiens?
I think it's a crucial shift in perspective. Even though mammals don't undergo those dramatic transformations like metamorphosis, every living thing is in constant flux, changing at the molecular level, at the physiological level, and of course, over generations. We're dynamic systems, always interacting with our surroundings, and that's a key part of evolution. This perspective helps us see that those lines between species, especially in the distant past, might have been much more fluid, with a lot of gene flow and adaptation happening.
It's like those neat boxes we try to put things in nature. It doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
So on the topic of fluidity, the source talks about the development of culture, languages, and even dietary taboos, and how all that initially strengthened tribal identity. But it's got less of an effect today, right?
Right. You see, as Homo sapiens spread across the globe, groups became more and more isolated geographically. So these innovations, different languages, specific dietary rules, like the ones that we see in some religions, they acted as barriers, reinforcing group identity. These cultural markers became really important for keeping those groups distinct. But fast forward to today, and the world is so much more interconnected. We've got global communication and travel, and those barriers, while they still exist, they're not as strong as they used to be.
So we're biologically mixed, and culturally, we're becoming more and more connected. Now let's talk about our timeline. The source estimates that Homo sapiens first emerged somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 years ago. That's an insanely long time. What was life like back then?
Yeah, it really is hard to wrap our heads around that kind of time scale. But for the vast majority of our existence as a species, we were hunter-gatherers. Our ancestors lived by foraging for plants and hunting animals, and this went on for millions of years. The switch to agriculture, that only happened around 10,000 years ago. To put that in perspective, imagine 10,000 generations living as hunter-gatherers compared to maybe 500 generations relying on agriculture.
That really emphasizes how deeply ingrained our hunter-gatherer past is in us. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, there's this seemingly random fact in our forest about using radiation and chemicals to create mutant plants during the Green Revolution. What's the connection there to human evolution?
It might seem like a bit of a leap, but it shows how humans are constantly trying to adapt and manipulate our environment, just like natural selection has been doing with us. The Green Revolution was all about using these methods to create plant varieties that could resist environmental stresses and increase food production. It was a way to prevent famine, and it worked. It's another example of humans intervening in biological processes, not for profit, but for survival.
Wow, that's a fascinating parallel. So let's talk about physical changes. The source contrasts the average lifespan of those early Homo sapiens living on a Paleolithic diet with how long we live today. What were those numbers?
So the average lifespan of early Homo sapiens on a Paleolithic diet, that was probably around 38 years. Now, we figure that out using what we call the genetic clock. We look at the rate of mutations in our genes and compare it to species where we know how long they live. And today, thanks to better nutrition and medicine, our average lifespan is way longer. Interestingly, our average height was actually higher around 50,000 years ago, about 180 centimeters. Then it went down for a bit before rising again.
Wait, we were taller back then. I would have thought it was the other way around.
It's one of those surprising things that highlights just how much environment and lifestyle can affect us.
Absolutely. Now, our source talks about how beneficial physical activity is for our brains. What are some of the big takeaways there?
Right. So it's not just about physical health. Even simple exercise, it increases blood flow to the brain. And more complex activities, they have even bigger benefits. They boost levels of something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, which helps our brains grow and stay healthy. They even improve the parts of the brain that regulate our emotions. It really shows how interconnected our bodies and minds are.
We're meant to move. Now let's get into the evolution of intelligence. The source mentions mutations accumulating, something called the intellectual deficiency risk group, and even this idea that intelligence might be declining. The Crabtree hypothesis. What's all that about?
This is a topic that sparks a lot of debate. Each generation, humans pick up an estimated 60 new mutations. The intellectual deficiency risk group, that refers to people with an IQ below 70. The Crabtree hypothesis basically suggests that over the past few thousand years, we might have accumulated mutations in genes that are related to intelligence. And theoretically, this could lead to a decline.
That's a little scary to think about. Are we actually getting dumber?
It's a provocative idea, but it's not widely accepted. In theory, natural selection should weed out mutations that are really harmful to intelligence. And the impact of any given mutation depends on the environment and the entire community, not just the individual.
Right. It's about how well we adapt, not just individual intelligence. So what are some of the counterarguments to this declining intelligence idea?
There are quite a few. The Flynn effect, for instance, that's the observed increase in IQ scores over the last century, and it directly contradicts the idea that we're getting less intelligent. Why it's happening is still debated, but it's a real trend. Another thing to consider is that IQ tests, they might not capture all the different aspects of intelligence. They don't really measure our ability to solve real-world problems or adapt to new situations. And psychologist Robert Sternberg, he talks about adaptive intelligence, this idea that intelligence is multifaceted, involving creativity, analytical skills, practical skills, and wisdom. He argues that we're getting better at some of these things, even if IQ scores aren't everything. We still have a lot of societal problems to solve.
So intelligence is complex. It's not just about what you score on a test.
Right. It's about so much more.
Now, looking at the long timeline of hominin evolution, our source points out that Homo erectus actually existed for a much longer period than Homo sapiens has so far. What can we learn from that?
Well, Homo erectus thrived for over 1.5 million years. That's pretty impressive, considering we, Homo sapiens, have only been around for a few hundred thousand. I think it's a humbling reminder that longevity isn't guaranteed. Environmental changes can wipe out even successful species. It's not always about being the smartest or strongest.
It's a reminder to stay humble. Now, what are some of the leading theories about why our brain size increased so much? Our source mentions hunting, eating meat, and also the role of fire.
Yeah, there are lots of ideas floating around. The theory about hunting and meat consumption, it's interesting, but not entirely convincing. Think about other predators, they eat meat too, but they didn't necessarily develop the same brain size as humans. The fire theory, that's a popular one. The idea is that cooking with fire makes food more nutritious, easier to digest, and it frees up time because you don't have to spend as much time foraging. Anthropologist Robin Dunbar estimated that before cooking, our ancestors probably spent more than 60% of their time just looking for food. But here's the thing. The evidence for fire use by Homo erectus that early on, like around 800,000 years ago, it's still debated. And those increases in brain size, they were already happening even earlier.
So it seems like fire might be part of the story, but not the whole story. Are there other possibilities for easier digestion that might have helped brains grow?
Definitely. Even before fire, there were other ways to process food, like pounding and grinding, and these would have made it easier to break down plants and access those nutrients. Also, we know that in hunter-gatherer societies today, gathering plants actually provides a lot of calories. Older women, they're often the main providers. So maybe the proportions were different back then, maybe there was more game available, and that shifted the balance. It was probably a combination of factors, really.
It sounds like there was a whole web of influences. The source also talks about this chart that links the emergence of different hominin species with changes in climate. What are some of the key connections there?
The chart basically shows how intertwined our evolution has been with those big environmental shifts. New hominin species often appear right around the time of significant climate changes. It suggests that these events, ice ages, warming periods, all that they probably created new ecological niches or challenges that drove adaptation.
Right, it's all connected. Now, let's not forget our evolutionary tree. It wasn't just a straight line. There were tons of branches. In fact, our source says there were something like 25 different human forms that existed over time. Some of them even lived alongside each other.
Exactly. It wasn't a ladder. It was more like a bush. We know of about 25 human-like forms. They didn't all just follow one after the other. Sometimes several of them existed at the same time, like Neanderthals and Homo sapiens.
And the source actually lists all these early hominins. It's like a who's who of our ancestors. Any highlights there that stand out to you in terms of understanding our journey?
They're all interesting in their own way, but some definitely stand out. Ardipithecus ramidus, that one's cool because it shows early signs of bipedalism, but it could still climb trees. Australopithecus afarensis, that's the famous Lucy. She was clearly walking upright, but had a more ape-like face. Then there's Paranthropus, a whole side branch that was adapted for chewing tough plants. And then we get to Homo, the genus we belong to, with Homo habilis, those were the toolmakers, and Homo erectus, those were the ones who really started to spread out of Africa and had those larger brains. And then, of course, the later forms, like Homo heidelbergensis and Homo neanderthalensis, they had brains that were comparable in size to ours, or even larger.
Wow. It's an amazing story of evolution. And speaking of evolution, the source mentions that our ancestors went through a really severe population bottleneck, with a total number of individuals dropping to under 1,300. That's cutting it pretty close. When did this happen and what might have caused it?
So from what we can tell from genetic analysis, this bottleneck happened somewhere between 813,000 and 930,000 years ago, and it brought our ancestors down to fewer than 1,300 individuals. These bottlenecks usually happen because of some kind of global catastrophe, and they lead to less genetic diversity, which can make populations more vulnerable. What caused it specifically, we're still trying to figure that out, but it shows just how precarious our early existence was.
We all almost didn't make it.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about Homo floresiensis for a minute, you know, the hobbit. Those small brains and small bodies, it's just so intriguing. What's the current thinking on where they came from?
Yeah, Homo floresiensis, they were around until about 50,000 years ago, and they're still a bit of a mystery. The leading theory is that they came from Homo erectus and evolved their smaller size due to something called island dwarfism. Basically, when resources are limited on an island, it can be advantageous to be smaller. But the truth is, without DNA analysis, we can't say for sure how they fit in.
It's like a paleontological puzzle waiting to be solved. And what about the Denisovans? We don't hear as much about them as Neanderthals. What do we know based on the research we have?
So the first Denisovan fossils, they were identified from DNA extracted from a finger bone found in Siberia back in 2010. Then, DNA from a femur found in Spain that revealed another unknown human ancestor, probably related to Denisovans. The thing is, we have very few Denisovan remains, some teeth, a finger bone, and that femur. Most of what we know comes from genetic analysis and this relatively new field called paleoproteomics, where scientists analyze ancient proteins.
So DNA has been key to understanding the Denisovans. Our source also mentions two more recent discoveries, Homo naledi and Homo longi, the dragon man. These are brand new to the scene, right?
They are. Homo naledi, that was discovered in South Africa in 2013, and there were a ton of bones found. Scientists are still analyzing them, and they're showing this really interesting mix of primitive and modern features. Homo longi, that's the one with the amazing skull from China. And it might be even closer to us, Homo sapiens, than Neanderthals are. It could even be Denisovan, but we need more data to be sure.
It seems like every new discovery adds another layer of complexity to the story.
It really does, and the source makes a really important point. Our family tree, it's not a simple linear progression. It's more like a tangled bush with lots of branches, some of them dying out, others leading to us.
Right, like a big, messy family reunion. And this idea of behavioral modernity, that's being rethought too, isn't it? What's changing there?
Yeah, behavioral modernity, that was this idea that Homo sapiens suddenly became super advanced in terms of tools, art, and all that. It was seen as this big leap forward. But now we're starting to see more and more evidence that early Homo sapiens, they were actually capable of a lot more than we gave them credit for. They were adapting their strategies, experimenting with different tools and techniques. And we have to remember, even those modern tribes that we might consider primitive, their cultures and ways of life, they're actually incredibly complex. They've had thousands of years to evolve their own unique solutions to the challenges they face.
That's a really important point. It's easy to impose our modern biases on the past. Okay, we've covered a lot about our physical and genetic evolution. Now let's talk about what sets us apart from other apes, our minds. Our source dives into the cognitive differences, starting with this idea that humans are much more focused on our internal thoughts compared to other animals.
Right. With our larger brains, we've got way more capacity for internal processing. Animals, they're mostly focused on what's happening in their immediate environment, responding to sensory input. Humans, we spend a lot more time thinking about abstract concepts, remembering the past and imagining the future. Now, the more advanced apes, like chimps, they show some signs of planning and imagination, but it's nowhere near the level we see in humans.
And the source mentions something called latent and implicit learning, which is seen in more primitive animals and even humans with anterograde amnesia. How does that fit in?
Latent learning, it's basically learning without consciously realizing you're learning. Implicit learning, it's similar, but it's more about skills and procedures. We see this in simpler animals, and it's also how people with anterograde amnesia who can't form new conscious memories can still learn new skills. It's like a basic level of learning that doesn't require higher level thinking or planning.
Interesting. But what really seems to set us apart is our ability to imagine the future and make decisions that benefit us in the long run. Animals show patience, sure, but not to the same extent.
You're absolutely right. Humans, we have this incredible capacity to imagine future consequences and make choices that benefit us in the long term, even when there's no immediate reward. We can delay gratification, and we can even understand abstract concepts like money and plan for things like retirement. Now, animals show patience too, don't get me wrong, but it's mostly related to concrete rewards like getting food. Humans can think about the big picture, and that makes a huge difference.
It's about having that long-term perspective. Now, let's talk about theory of mind. The ability to understand other people's perspectives. This develops in humans around 4 or 5 years old. How does this compare to what we see in other apes?
Theory of mind, that's a big one. It's crucial for human social interaction. It's the ability to understand that other people have their own thoughts, beliefs, and intentions, and that those might be different from your own. And as you said, it fully develops in humans around 4 or 5 years old. Now, there's a lot of research suggesting that some primates, they do show a basic level of understanding other individuals' intentions, and they seem to be able to do this based on context. So it's not like it's entirely unique to humans, but our version of theory of mind is definitely much more advanced.
So we're not the only ones who can get inside each other's heads, but we're definitely the best at it. What about theory of other minds? How do great apes fare on that one?
Theory of other minds? That's even more sophisticated. It's not just about understanding that someone else has intentions. It's about being able to use that knowledge to predict their behavior, to manipulate them, to cooperate with them. And in that area, great apes seem to be a bit less developed. They don't consistently follow gaze, respond to pointing, or readily share discoveries, or cooperate in tasks. It seems like a small difference, but it could have had a big impact on our evolution.
It's fascinating how these subtle cognitive differences can have such huge consequences. And our source points out some other seemingly small things that made a big difference, like how human babies, they have their hands free to grasp and explore, unlike ape babies who have to cling to their mothers.
That's a great example. Having those free hands, it allowed for much earlier development of fine motor skills. And on top of that, human parents, they're much more involved in teaching their offspring, helping them learn. This isn't as common in apes. The development of what we call shared intentionality and synchronized attention, where individuals can focus on something together, work together towards a common goal, that was probably a pivotal moment in our evolution. It paved the way for complex collaboration and the development of culture.
It's amazing how these small initial differences can snowball into such huge evolutionary changes. Now, the source makes an important point about comparing modern humans to present-day apes. They say we need to be careful about making those direct comparisons. Why is that?
Because we're not comparing apples to apples. Even those isolated tribes, they've gone through thousands of years of cultural evolution. And remember, modern apes, they've also been evolving all this time, but on a separate path. So what we see in apes today, it might not perfectly reflect the capabilities of our last common ancestor. We can't assume that they're stuck in time.
That's a great point. Everyone's evolving. Everyone's on their own journey. The source provides a timeline of Homo sapiens' dispersal across the globe. It took quite a while for us to really spread out, didn't it?
It did. The earliest fossils, those are in Africa, of course, from over 200,000 years ago. In Near East, that's around 80,000 to